I would like to start by thanking all the committee that put these things together. I know that it just doesn't happen. A lot of people did a lot of hard work. How about one more time for the committee? I was a little bit put on and put out because I only got three letters from Stephanie. And until Stephanie explained to her that Jenny had been writing the letters anyway, I felt a little better. I got three letters from Stephanie, and I got one from Jenny. So now I feel okay about it. I think we'll have a happy time tonight. You know, these are happy programs. My name's Bob Smith, and I'm an enthusiastic member of Al-Anon. I think that to be an Al-Anon, there's four things I must do. I must live the steps. I think I must abide by the traditions. I think I must attend the meetings regularly, and I think I need to have a sponsor. And I do these things. I don't think you're automatically an Al-Anon. It requires some work on our part. My first sponsor was a woman. When I came into the program 23 years ago, the only guy that was around was about the age of my son, and I didn't think we had too much going. So I found a lady that's even older than I, and she's been my service sponsor ever since. Now, I know we do not encourage speakers of the opposite sex, but you can tell by looking at me that it really isn't a very serious problem. Now, don't misunderstand me. I love to see you beautiful ladies. I just can't remember why. I think one third of our triangle is service, and I've tried to do that. I've been the GR, and I've been the DR, and I served 3 years with the West Texas Assembly. And several years ago, I got a call from our central office asking me if I'd consider myself to be a candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And I seemed to have the educational requirements and the business experience that they needed at the time. And I prayed about it and talked to my group. And I called them back up and said, yes, please put my name on, be candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And guess what? I didn't get it. My first reaction was, well, why did they bother me? But then what I want to tell you is my program came to my rescue like it always did and said, hey, whoever got that job was capable of doing a much better job than you, was capable of filling a need that they had at the time, and maybe our Heavenly Father has something else for me to do, and I'm totally free of that. And that's one of the beautiful things that my program will do for me. I think I got to Al-Anon like most Al-Anons. I love an alcoholic. My wife, who died 4 years ago, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 19 years sober at the time she died. And so we had a happy program together. I came in, I started this journey with you in April of 1979. My home group is a anchor group in Gainesville, Texas, and that has been the first group I attended in my group ever since. Although I've only been a member of Al-Anon for 23 years, I am somewhat of an anachronism. I'm the only person still living that was present when the two co-founders met for the very first time. Akron, Ohio, Mother's Day, 1935. My dad's Dr. Bob and my mom's Ann, and I rode out with my parents to meet with Bill for the very first time. And it's scary. I'm the last one standing that was there because CAA started in our home. Bill came and lived at our house all that summer, and that's the time AA started. And now my beautiful sister, Sue, died in February, and I'm the last one that was there when this organization started. It's really kind of scary. But then there's one little nasty point that I'd like to point out to you. Nobody can say to you, to me, now, Bob, that's not the way it happened. If I say it, it's gospel. Oh, we'll have a happy time together. My dad had come home the day before Mother's Day with a potted plant, and he'd set it down. He was potted. Went upstairs and passed out. My mom was a friend of Henrietta Cyberling's, and Henrietta called and said, Ann, there's a man out here that thinks he can help Bob. Bring him right on out. Well, Mom had to explain to Henrietta that Bob was in no shape to talk to anybody. But she said, I'll get him out there tomorrow. Well, my dad, Mom, and I rode together. He had a terrible hangover. He said one of the worst ones he'd ever had. He said, okay, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want. But it wasn't 15 minutes. He and Bill went off in a room by themselves, and they talked for many hours. And as a result of that meeting, and at my mom's invitation, Bill came and he lived at our home all that summer. So I would like to take you with me, if I may, in my memory to those times, to show you that several things, that the program actually started from nothing. And I think that's important. I want to talk about that because there may be somebody here whose life right now is in that situation where you think you're just starting over from nothing. And I want to talk to you about what I consider to be miracles. You can imagine what it's like in looking at it in my eyes, if you would. Two people, 1935, to the organizations all over the world. Absolute miracles. And I want to talk to you about recovery. I love to hear people talk about recovery. You know, if I'm in a meeting and it's an hour into this guy's talking, he's still stealing hubcaps in front of the same bar, I think it's going to be a long night. I like to hear recovery. What worked? What didn't work? Well, it was in the middle of the last Great Depression. We lived in a one-industry town, Akron, Ohio. All the tire manufacturers were there. Goodyear, Goodrich, General, Firestone, Cyberling, Miller. And when the Depression hit, people stopped buying cars and they didn't need tires, and that town just fell flat on its face economically. And I think that this was, again, providentially arranged because people had more time for each other. They weren't as hurried and harried as we are today. And that was absolutely necessary to get the input from everybody so that we could come up with viable programs. We didn't have any money. I doubt if Bill and my dad could have raised 50 bucks between them. Totally broke. But you know, God doesn't care who he uses as their agent. Somehow the time was just right to start something that had been needed for very, very many years. So Bill came to our house, moved in with us, and my mom wrote to Lois, our beloved Al-Anon co-founder, and Lois came down and stayed with us as long as she could that summer. But Lois had to get back to New York City. You just got to understand, Lois is the only one that had a job. But it was the start of a friendship that lasted until Lois passed away in the not too far past. Okay. As near as I could tell, these two guys had two things going for them. I got to tell you, I was a teenager at the time, so I kind of knew what was going on. They had two things going for them. They both had open spiritual minds, and they had the desire to be of service to another human being. I'd like to tell you about my dad. You know, the pictures of him always look so grim, but he wasn't that way at all. He was a delightful guy. When I brought my bride-to-be home in the 1940s, my wife was tall and slender, and Dad looked her over and got me aside and said, she's built for speed and light housekeeping. And And I'd like to tell you, sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. He got me up in the bathroom one day, and I thought, oh boy, I'm going to find out all about it now. And he closed the door, and he said to me, flies spread disease. Keep yours buttoned. And he was a wonderful sport, although a highly educated man. He had some sort of an old car that was pretty well used up, used a lot of gasoline, and he wanted to go back to Vermont and then up into Quebec. And I had an old Ford Roadster that I had bought for less than $30. And he said, do you think that Ford will go to Vermont and then up into Canada? And I said, yeah, Dad, it runs pretty well, really, I think it will. But the reason it was so cheap, I didn't get the top. I said, what are we going to do when it rains? He said, we're going to get wet. And we toured all through with that old Ford, a high school buddy of mine and my dad. He was a great sport. He was tall, thin, Vermonter, had icy blue eyes. Went along pretty much on an even keel. Thought things over very carefully and didn't none of that off the top of your head. Now, Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter. They were born within 100 miles of each other. Bill at East Dorset, my dad at St. Johnsbury. Total opposites. And again, I think that was providentially arranged. Bill's mood swung. He was either high as a Georgia pine or low as a snake. Bill was a promoter. Bill was a salesman. Bill was a visionary. I think Bill Wilson could see further up the road than any human I've ever known. On the other hand, my dad just went along on a pretty steady keel. He was kind of the balance wheel of the two. And I've heard it said that if Alcoholics Anonymous had been left up to Dr. Bob Smith, it'd still be in Ohio. And if Alcoholics Anonymous were left up to Bill Wilson, he'd have sold it to a franchise. But these two guys had the idea to be of service to another human being. Now, nobody had any money. Hospital beds were $16 a day. I think they're up a little now, but nobody had any money. So they began taking these wet alcoholics into our home. Now, this was the start of recovery. My dad would take a new guy upstairs and say, now, fella, I'm going to give you this little bit of medicine, but I want you to, I'm going to give you a shot of whiskey first, but I want you to take the medicine. It was a paraldehyde, a very pungent sedative. And he knocked him out from 24 to 36 hours. He really gave him a jolt. And when the guy came to, they brought them downstairs, and he and Bill had worked out a standard diet. And this is what it was. It was canned tomatoes, sauerkraut. Bill had an ulcer, and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And Cairo syrup. I think you'll agree the early alcoholics were a hardy group. The one I want to tell you about is someone that nobody knows much about, and I think she wanted it that way, and that's my mom. Mom was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges back in the East, and she went there on a scholarship. And her great uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad. And in those days, the president of the railroad had a very opulent car, train car, that could tie onto trains wherever trains went. And he liked my mom and would take her with him on some of these trips. So she got to see the opulent, genteel side of life. Mom was a school teacher. Mom had led a very sheltered and protected life. Was very easily shocked until AA. But now this is the lady that said, hey, Bill, come live with us. She didn't say, come over and have lunch with us next Tuesday. She said, Bill, come live with us. Maybe you two can work out something. And I think that is a little miracle. Now, remember, Bill lived in New York City, and we lived in Akron, Ohio. And I think another miracle was Bill said, okay. So he moved into the house, and this was a start, I think, of many, many, many little nudging miracles that our Heavenly Father has allowed to happen in order that these programs would progress and not destroy themselves. Well, my sister and I were teenagers, and of course, if we came home and opened the front door, if we smelled formaldehyde, we knew we'd lost our bed. Susie went to the couch in the living room, I went to the attic. And some of these guys, you know, were not just overnight guests. Arch T, who started AA later on in Detroit, stayed almost a year. But this was recovery. And we loved it. It was so much better than life had been. The first 17 years of my life, I was raised in a home with active alcoholism. Were any of you raised in an alcoholic home? Would you raise your hand? Wow. Okay, let me touch on that just a minute, if I may. I think that we get to adulthood with some scars. I don't doubt that for a minute. Some more scarred than others. I think that all of us developed our own way of coping at the time, and as little kids, our way of handling it. I was a runner. I got out of that house and I stayed as long as I could away from there without getting into trouble. Never invited anyone into the house because we never knew what we were going to find. But the thing that I must guard against, and I speak only for myself, is that I must not consider myself a victim. Set a victim mindset. That all the screw-ups I did, all the bad things I did, all the things I was supposed to do, I didn't do, was not my fault because I'm a victim. I'm a victim. And you know, this works. This works beautifully, but there's a price right up front that you see. And the price is this. In order to maintain that victim mindset, I have to increasingly resent somebody, some group of people, some event, something. Increasingly resent that. And we all know from our programs the one thing that will totally destroy us is resentment. So I'm not a victim. I'm a survivor. Is the way I look at it. And personally, and I speak only for myself, I do not intend to remain forever frozen in the mindset of an injured adolescent. We know how to grow up. Our programs give us the freedom. Okay. At first, it was just a trickle. Now, my mom is the one that was inviting these guys in. My mom was the one that was answering the phone because we started getting inquiries. Loved ones were inquiring. And mom was the one that made the beds. And mom was the one that cleaned up the messes. And mom is the one that cooked the food. And mom is the one that never lost faith in these two guys that they might someday come up with something that would work. She never lost faith. And Bill said, Ann Smith is the mother of AA, and I truly believe this. Mom was the one who realized from the word go that this was a program that affected the whole family. And in the early part of 1936, Mom organized a women's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach patients love and tolerance. And you know, when Lois and Ann B., not my mom, but Ann B., rode around to the AA groups around the country to see if there was any interest in a program like Al-Anon, she found out there were 64 groups already doing it. Independent thinking, have figured it out in their own minds and were doing something about it. So people realized from the word go that it not only affected the alcoholic, but the family as well. My sister and I loved this bringing the wet drunks into the house. You know, the blank eyes, pretty soon a little twinkle, then you've got a viable human being on your hands. And this was exciting. You know, we were teenagers, and you can imagine a house full of wet alcoholics. there was action going on all the time, and it was it was great. It was great, and we loved it. And at first, it was just a trickle. The first one I remember that Dad and Bill tried to work with was a young man by the name of Eddie R. Eddie had just been thrown out of his house for non-payment of rent with a cute little blonde wife and two stair-step kids. So they moved the whole family into our house, took Eddie upstairs and locked him in the upstairs where he'd be available, you know, as they got this knowledge. Well, you got to remember, folks, nothing's written. They're just trying to stay a page ahead of Eddie. But Eddie was an agile young guy, and we had downspouts, and Eddie would open the second story window, slide down the downspouts, and escape. And they had to recapture Eddie in order to continue his treatment. And one time, Eddie got as far away as Cleveland, Ohio, called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide. But that he would give them time to drive up and witness the event. Can you imagine a more inauspicious start? And when they brought Eddie back and got him sobered up, he had some other little things that hadn't surfaced immediately, and he began beating up on this little blonde lady to whom he was married, and then he began chasing my mom around the house with a butcher knife. So we held a group conscience meeting. And it was decided the only thing to do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and recommit him in a mental institution. And this was done. And Bill and Dad were crestfallen. Here's their first attempt. Total failure. But I want to tell you folks something. At my dad's funeral, 15 years later, a guy walked up to me, and he said, "Do you know me?" And I looked over at him, and I said, "Yeah, I know you. You're Eddie." And he said, "That's right." And he said, "I want you to know I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year." So we don't know the result of that 12-step call. Our part is to take the hand that reaches out for help. That's our part. And we don't have to be fully qualified to do it. We go with what we have. That's okay. You don't have to be. I don't think anybody ever gets to be fully qualified to make a 12-step call. And sometimes they're discouraging. I've been on one where obviously the person I called on wished I wasn't there. And pretty soon I wished I wasn't there. But you know, we're not responsible for the result. I think the result depends on the zeal of the person receiving the message and perhaps the will of our Heavenly Father. But our part is to always take that hand that reaches out for help. It was just a trickle at first, and then the media got a hold of it. First an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and then Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post. And boy, it became an absolute deluge. The word got out that there was a doctor in Akron, Ohio, could quote fix drunks. And they came in on the bus and on the train, dropped off by loving relatives. Dropped off by relatives who weren't so loving. And again, I think our Heavenly Father provided the right person at the right time. Sister Ignatia. Sister was the admitting nurse at a Catholic hospital there in Akron. And she and my dad prevailed upon the Mother Superior to allow them to start a little alcoholic ward, whereby for the first time people could be admitted with a disease of alcoholism. Now what it was the flower room, you know, where they arrange the flowers for the patients and trim them and so forth. And it was 7 cots. And I often wonder what the early alcoholics thought when they woke up and looked around. There's nothing but flowers. But anyway, it's no longer the flower room. It occupies the entire fifth floor. Been in that hospital facility all that time. My wife and I attended the first international in 1950. My dad was terminally ill at the time, gave a short talk. This is the international where they adopted the 12 traditions which we both programs use. See, Bill had gone around the country in about 47 asking groups to accept these traditions, and groups were then like they are now. They said, Bill, go on back to New York and run that like you want to. We'll run this like we want to here. And they wouldn't pay any attention to it. So six guys got up, and each of them read two of the traditions, and they adopted them unanimously. And I say, thank the good Lord for that. These traditions are what the glue that holds us together, folks. And did you ever stop and think what a wonderful damage control they are? Somehow they managed to anticipate the things that would have come in and destroyed these movements. The first 11 of those 12 traditions are beautiful damage control. Let me give you a for instance of that. The seventh tradition was self-supporting through our own contribution. Early on, the liquor distillers wanted to give alcoholics big money, wanted to give AA big money. But of course, if they had accepted it, there would have been some strings attached. You know, it wouldn't have been just a free will gift. And somehow they said, no, we will not take outside contributions, we're self-supporting through our own contribution. That has to be a little miracle, because they were so pitifully broke. Dad was dying. My mom had died the year before, and he was lonesome, and he was old. And you see, Dad only lived 15 years, but in that length of time, he personally, without charge, medically and AA-wise, treated over 5,000 alcoholics. And I like to think of my dad as being Mr. 12-Step. He did it, and he was very effective. But anyhow, he gave this short talk, and then we drove him back to his beloved Vermont one more time. And I wouldn't take for the caring and the sharing that we did as we rode along in the car and sat on the edge of the bed at night with this wonderful guy. Brought him back to Akron, Ohio, and at the time I had a flying job out of Dallas, and I had to get back to work. I never saw my dad alive again. But what a treat it was getting to be with him. Bill invited us to the second international in 1955 in St. Louis. And this is the one where they recognized the spiritual leaders, the people that were in the religion that had loved AA when AA wasn't cool. Like Dr. Sam Shoemaker of New York City and Father Ed Dowling of St. Louis. And these people gave talks, and they were recorded word for word, and they're in the book AA Comes of Age, a chapter religion looks at AA, if any of you are interested. And then we didn't attend any internationals for a while. My wife and I were party animals. We loved to dance, and we loved to drink, and we went merrily on our way. And I sure wasn't telling anybody my father was Dr. Bob Smith. But once in a while, they would ask us, find out about it, and ask us to come to a meeting, and we would. And we enjoyed it. And on the way home, we would talk to each other and say, oh, good for them. They needed that. And all the while, alcoholism was working in our home. You know, I like to think of alcoholism as, being, at least in the way it worked with us, three stages: fun, fun and problems, problems. And we were deep, deep into the problem area. But we didn't give up. We didn't say, oh, hot dog, this is the goal of a lifetime. One of us can join AA and the other can join Al-Anon. No, we kept trying to change things up a little bit, make it work. Let me tell you a little story. Two hunters loved to hunt way up in the wilds in the north woods, and they would hire an aviation company to fly them in to a lake and leave them there and then pick them up a week later. The little plane came in, landed on the lake, and one of the hunters said, "Oh, we've had a wonderful hunt. We've got three moose." And the pilot said, "You two guys, me, and three moose in this little airplane? I don't think so." And one of them said, "Oh," I said, "the fellow came in with a hunter with a plane just exactly like yours last year." And he said, "What the pilot did was he taxied up the river and got a longer run on the lake, and we didn't have any trouble getting in the air." So the pilot thought, "Well, I've got to try it." So he did, and sure enough, the little plane takes off, and they start back to civilization. But the engine's working so hard, it begins to overheat and loses power, and way out in the middle of no place, the plane crashes. And one of the hunters drags his buddy out from under the plane and dusts him off, and his buddy looked around and said, "Oh, where in the world are we?" The other one said, "You know, I think we're within 100 yards of where we crashed last year." And that was us, trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, when it finally got bad enough, as it often happens, a young pharmacist called up my wife and said, "Betty, we're starting a group here in Nocona, Texas, for people that have a problem like you and me. Will you come?" And she said, "Yes, I will." And she went, and she was one of the founders of that little group, never took another drink as long as she lived. And worked at her program so hard, she was running off and leaving me. Can you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. She was running off and leaving me in the dust. She was trying everything she could to make it work. And I was just left standing there, and I thought, well, gee, I would like to get some of this too. So it really wasn't a program of attraction for me. I wanted what these people had. So someone said to me, "Well, Bob, why don't you join Al-Anon?" And I thought, well, why not? I don't mind joining the auxiliary. So I got in my car and I drove 40 miles over to Gainesville, and I showed up at my first Al-Anon meeting, walk in the room, and I look around, and I'm the only guy. Room full of women, I'm the only man. Well, I immediately got mixed emotions about Al-Anon. I like to describe mixed emotions this way. It's kind of like the feeling you get when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 in the morning with a Gideon Bible under her arm. But I stayed. And I really laid a trip on those gals. You know, the rock that had been holding the family together. Noble but unbowed. A little bloody maybe, but still hanging in there tough. And they listened to me. And I do think that we need to listen to that kind of a story. Once. And I left there knowing I'd made a wonderful impression on those women. And you know, these things are revealed to us later on when we can handle them. I talked to Ann, one of the ladies that was there, and said, "Oh yeah, Bob, I remember that meeting." Said, "After you left, we held a meeting." And we said, "There's one that's not going to make it." And none of them would sponsor me either. But anyhow, thank gosh they hung in there. And I dearly love those women for taking me in until I finally could start learning on my own. Well, everything was going along great in our family. My wife was attending her Alcoholics Anonymous program. I was attending Al-Anon. We had four children. One of them had a bachelor's and two had master's degrees, and one of them had his doctorate. And we were pretty well, the dog had finally died. We were pretty well free and just free to go do the things we always wanted to do. And I got a phone call one night. My oldest son, Scott. Scott had a master's degree cum laude from the University of Texas and was a member of Mensa, you know, the people with the genius IQ. Scott had no problem with drug or booze. He'd gone to work that day. He was a top BMW salesman in Dallas. Something happened at work. He went out in his car, sat in his car, pulled out his gun, and blew his brains out. A terrible thing. You know, you can only imagine. Well, some of you can. Some of you, I'm sure, have been there. But no parent wants to outlive their children. And it was a terrible thing to go through, knowing this beautiful guy had thought that he no longer could live in this world. But the point I want to make is that the program and the people in it held us in their hand and cupped hands and propped us up until we were able to stand up on our own again. And 6 months later, my beautiful wife came down with terminal lung cancer. And I dragged her around trying to do everything that we could. And finally, she said to me, "I know what you're doing, Bob." Said, "But I'm not afraid to die." Said, "I release you. Will you release me?" And I said, "Yes, I will." And I released her, and she died. And again, the program and the people in it propped me up until I could stand alone again. And I tell you this because, not so much to get your sympathy, but to show you what happens if you live long enough. These things happen. This is life on life's terms, folks. Not on our terms, but on life's terms. And the help is there for us. The help is there for us in our programs. I had trouble with this program, did you? We had a lot of anger, both ways. Lots of anger. And we had to work through that. I had to learn some of these little beautiful sayings like, "Oh, I didn't know you felt that way about it." Or I love this one, "You may be right." You know, you're really not giving up a darn thing, but it stops a fight. And it takes two to continue a fight. But these little things were helpful to me. And I had to learn about a God of my understanding, a loving God. You know, I was raised in the Episcopalian Church. That's Catholic light. You know, all the pageantry without the guilt. Yeah. And the God that was presented to me was up there waiting for me to screw up, and he was going to get me, zap me. And that wasn't a very good concept of a God. I changed. In World War II, I was a bomber pilot, and I flew 45 missions in the old four-engine Liberator out of Africa, and our losses were very heavy. And I had a different relationship with God. I had a 911 relationship. Did any of you ever make deals with God? God, if you'll get me out of this mess, I swear I will. And that was a relationship I had. And now through this, my Al-Anon program, I have a loving God, a heavenly Father, one who talks to me and one who I can talk to just like I can talk to you. It's a beautiful, beautiful concept. With me wherever I go. You know, I talk to him just like I talk to you. God, did you see that SOB cut us off? Beautiful, beautiful relationship with God. I thank him every night and I pray to him every day and I try to keep my prayers on helping others rather than things that I think I need, because God already knows what I need. And I have to be careful what you pray for. You're liable to get it. But this is another beautiful, beautiful benefit of the program. And I want to talk to you a little bit about honesty. You know, I always was what I call cash register honest. You know, the girl at the change at the grocery store would give me too much change, and I'd say, "Oh, here, you gave me too much money." And I would go through the day just noble as could be. And then I think there's another degree of honesty, and I call it resume honesty. That's when you basically tell the truth, but you gussy it up a little so you look good, you know. And then there's program honesty. That's total honesty. When I can be completely honest with you, show you me warts and all, and you do the same thing for me, we can have an instant, intimate. And I know of no other organizations in the world with which I can do this. Makes no difference our age, our walk in life, whatever. We can have an instant, intimate friendship. And that's a result of working the program as we are supposed to do. I want to talk to you about miracles, because maybe there's somebody here whose life is just starting this program again, and you're in bad need of a miracle. Well, these programs are absolute, in my opinion, miracles. Everyone here is a miracle. Let me run one or two by you. You know, Bill and Dad were absolutely broke. They had no money. And they thought, wouldn't it be great if we had some dough? We could start treatment centers, and I'm sure my father could see himself in his white coat greeting the patients, and maybe Bill out on the streets flagging them in, you know. So they went to New York City and met with people with very deep pockets. And Mr. Rockefeller's group listened very carefully and then said, "No, money will ruin it." That's a miracle. Now think what would have happened in your mind's eye, if you will. What would have happened if Mr. Rockefeller had dumped $1 million on 100 broke alcoholics? It's just horrible to even think about, isn't it? I bet we wouldn't be sitting here tonight. Miracle. Anonymity. In the early days of these programs, there were people with huge egos. Now, I know we don't have any of that anymore. But you can't be Mr. AA or Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is. And another thing that has done, it doesn't make any difference if you've been here 4 days or 45 years. We're all exactly the same. And isn't that the way it's supposed to be? Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? And that's an absolute miracle. Absolute miracle. I could talk to you about them all day long. Even the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, written by people who weren't authors, about a few things that really hadn't happened. The first 164 pages are just the same as they were when they were written originally, except maybe for one word. Bill had had a spiritual experience. It had come on him like a huge light all at once. Most of us don't get it that way. So they changed that one word to having had a spiritual experience to having had a spiritual what? Awakening. And that's the only change. And think of the millions of alcoholics that have tried to find a loophole in those first 164 pages. Somehow they managed to plug them all. And that's a miracle. So if you're new here, and your life is starting perhaps over from nothing, so did these programs. If you're bad in need of a miracle, these programs are miraculous. All of us here are miracles. We'd love to talk to you. You don't bother us. You strengthen us. We'd love to talk to you. Talk to us. Hang in there with us. Hang in there with us until you realize that you've got your own miracle. But right now you may just have your miracle coming, but don't you dare quit before your miracle. Hang in there. You know, my Heavenly Father never slams one door shut, but what he doesn't open, another one. And I got to tell you about this. I've got a lady in my life. I have a fiance, and we're going to get married this fall. She's been a widow 11 years. I've been a widower for 4 years. And she said, AA, 25 years sober in the program. You know how us Al-Anons can home in on one? We can spot one at 100 yards. So we have hopes of being together. And we're both old, and the kids think it's all going to be okay. One of Mona's daughters said she thought it over very carefully and said, well, Mom, you know he has alcoholism in his family. So anyhow, that's the way my life is going now. Another door is open for me, like it will for you. I thank every one of you. I've had a wonderful time with you tonight. Thank you. Thank you, baby. Thank you. That's good.